I'm always so fascinated to see what you're wearing and how you're presenting yourself every time you pop up on my Zoom screen.
You look exactly the same every time.
It's like you look like Master of Disguise with the stocking cap. The beard is more full. And you look a little trimmer. Have you kept kind of working on yourself a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, this week has been pretty money. I've been eating well, drinking celery juice in the morning, just shitting everywhere. It's good. Running, you know.
Shitting while running.
Yeah, I wear a diaper. No, but it's been good. And I just got back from a camping trip, actually, which was awesome.
I was going to ask you about that. So in the age of coronavirus and quarantine, you can go camping. And I'm assuming, knowing you the way I know you, there was no tent involved. This isn't like, let's sleep out under the sky.
First of all, that's like an insult.
But am I right?
Yes.
Okay.
But I camp under the stars. What do you mean? I'm like a mountain man, you know?
Oh, really? Is that how you fancy yourself?
You see me as like this bourgeois, like, you know.
Yeah, sort of. you portend to be low maintenance, but you can be high maintenance. I've seen it.
You're way more high maintenance than I am. But anyway, so no, it was a cabin. It was called El Capitan, and it's sort of glamping-ish, but not crazy. You know, there's no room service or shit like that. There's canvas tents, and it's every third place was rented out. So you're automatically socially distancing, you know.
Did you mingle? Did you meet some new friends?
No, you don't even really see anybody. That's what was so great about it. And it felt like sort of, you know, the real world a little bit. We made, you know, campfires and we cooked over the fires and we brought all of our own food. And, you know, then we walked down to the beach. It was near like a sort of a state beach. The state beach was a little scary because there were people on it. But I will say that everyone was sort of doing a good job of staying away from each other. But it was beautiful, man. It was just nice to get out.
Good weather? Do you have nice weather?
Amazing weather. Just super fun. Kids had a blast.
I'm happy for you because during this entire time, you've been so frustrated with the fact that I can lawfully go play golf. I can go hit balls. I can get outside. As long as we socially distance and I can stand on the driving range and just practice my golf swing, something that you and I love doing. And I've been able to do that. So I'm actually in a selfless mode today. And I'm happy for you that you got a chance to go out and feel somewhat normal.
It was nice. It was nice. It was very good. And then we had a Zoom call we had a little Zoom drink with Michelle and Aaron.
Oh, yeah. That was dangerous because we're 2 hours, but we're in St. Louis, you're in LA. So we get on, you know, typical Hudson planning. We're supposed to get on at 8:30 our time, 6:30 your time. That kind of pushed its
way
at 9:07. I don't care. That's not the point of this. The point of that
we
I'm
had
making,
a school thing.
Is Michelle and I had been drinking wine until you guys showed up. Then we drank more wine waiting for you guys to show up. Then we drank wine while we were talking to you. And at the end of it, we're like, Jesus, we staggered back to
a
room.
But I love Michelle. I love how no bullshit she is. And she just can just, and she could just annihilate you and just rip you apart without fear. I love it. It's so great.
Why? Well,
she's
well,
not afraid. She's just unafraid to say things that
why would anybody I'm married to be afraid to say
well,
anything?
Well, because she reveals private things about your relationship and certain things that you did and certain words that you may or may not have called her. You know what I mean? Like,
oh,
no, I'm just saying, like, she's so candid and open and
she's great. She is everything I'm not. She is candid, open. She's patient. Mm-hmm. I am not. I'm a 51-year-old dad with two kids that are two, and my patience is at a one on a scale of 1 to 100. I'm going to one. And by the end of the day, I'm shot. Like, I try to work out. I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I can't.
Why do you get up at 6 in the morning?
That's when they get up. I'd love to not get up at 6. I'd love to, but it's we're on their schedule. As you know, you've been there.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, dude, I get
it. So I'm flat ass tired at the end of the day. But it was nice to see
you.
But
you had a nice, yeah, it was. And you had a nice little romantic session after that, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And actually, Michelle wanted me to ask you on this podcast, now that you say that, I'm glad you brought that up, because she actually had a question, like,
okay,
Ask Ollie, the Ask Ollie segment.
We should do that.
If a great session, if a great mm-hmm. lovemaking,
mm-hmm.
whatever, mm-hmm. tete-a-tete, can cover for the fact that, you know, you're not going at it every day. Can you live off what was a crazy great night longer than you can live off just mundane?
Yes. Yeah. See, that's a great question. It is, because I think probably I can only speak for myself. There's a conundrum with this for me, and I'm not saying this is every man or every person, but for me, if I have a great sex session, there is a satisfaction, yes, but there's also more of a desire. I get more fired up. Like, the next day, I'll be like, oh my God, that was so good. And then I want it more and more. So it's sort of like, it's a double-edged sword for Aaron, you know, because if it is just like on another level, ooh, I like wake up, I want it more. And la, 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 it sort of lights the fire.
So then she has to put up with you.
Yeah, yeah. So it's her job to make it like pretty good, you know?
Yeah, that's an interesting balance she has to find.
Yeah, she's got to find that balance of like, you know, that was pretty good. But if she takes it to like a holy shit
like
level.
Hanging off the chandeliers.
Yeah, then she knows that she's screwed, like figuratively and literally, for the next week, because I get all juiced up, you know? But I think that's every couple has a different feeling about that. But quality over quantity, I would say, for sure, just generally.
So I've never been less psyched that both my daughters listen to this podcast. It's like when I went on Stern for the second time and Michelle was there, and then she came in the studio,
mm-hmm.
and that was surreal to be there at Stern as the main guest and be having been asked back, which was a great compliment.
Yeah.
For you know, a guy who's admittedly not a huge sports fan in Howard, and then to have him bring her out, and there we are talking about our sex life. My now almost 24-year-old was like, oh my God. Oh God, that's disgusting.
Like, and I really by the way, that's do they not act kindly to sort of your hearing about your sex life? Like, do they listen to this show? Do they listen to our show?
Yeah, my daughters are obsessed with this show. They were already fans of just about everybody we've had.
Mm-hmm.
But Nikki Glaser was already.
And do they not like when you're talking about your sex life or your penis? You know,
well, we really haven't. I usually deftly step away from that part of the conversation. I let you kind of go there and I just watch from the bench. And in this case, mm-hmm. I'm the one bringing it up because it was a question posed by my wife, star of ESPN's Monday Night Football, Michelle Beisner-Buck.
So you don't want to talk about your penis. Like, that's an off-limits topic for you.
I don't really think anybody's that interested in...
In what?
My penis.
Oh, you said it.
Or yours, or Sims, for that matter.
I now that I know that Trudy and Natalie sort of listen to it a lot, I just, it's going to be my goal just to make them as uncomfortable as possible.
That's fine. As long as they know that it's like a thing that you're trying to do, then that's good, I think. If it's just me oversharing for the sake of oversharing...
Mm-hmm.
Or to be a little bit more open than I typically might be, then it's a different thing.
Do you think your girls like me or are you more on the podcast? Do they think they like what you're doing or what I'm doing, or is it just we're a team?
I think we're a team. I think we're good. We're good yin and yang here. You're Oscar. I'm Felix. You're Tennille. I'm Captain. Mm. You're Cher. I'm Sonny.
I'll be Cher.
You're Gopher. I'm Doc.
I'd be a better Cher than you. Anyway.
No, you're Doc. I'm Gopher. You'd mm-hmm. be a better Cher. I know. That's why I said you're Cher and I'm Sonny.
That's the only reference that I knew Captain Tennille and Tennille, but like the other ones went
Gopher way over and Duff from the Love Boat. You're not that.
Yeah, I know, but you know,
I'm Mr. Rourke. Your tattoo.
Got it.
I'm Fantasy going through Island. The whole CBS yeah. Sunday night.
Right. Tour. Like I'm Gilligan. Yes. You're the skipper.
Yes. I'm Tim Conway. You're Harvey Korman from the Carol Burnett Show.
I thought it was going to be John Travolta.
You're John Travolta. I'm Horseshack. Hey, so this week was an interesting week because I found out that by going on Andy Cohen's show and talking about sports coming back and how it will theoretically look on television and sound, I think even more importantly from where I sit on television, I said the same stuff on Andy Cohen and his radio show on Sirius that I've said for literally the last month. Whether it's been on this podcast, I said it on HBO Real Sports, which should be the biggest stage that mm-hmm. you could talk about this kind of stuff on. And me saying that Fox, and I think all networks, will put some kind of ambient crowd noise under a broadcast was like mind-blowing to people. And then I said Fox is working on having it look like there's a crowd there. And I meant it. They are. And they're working on 100 things, mm-hmm. probably 90 of which will not come to fruition, look right, feel right, sound right, whatever. But it just blew up everywhere. And then all of a sudden, I'm the spokesperson for Fox and coming back to TV with sports. And that's the last thing that I wanted. My point of it all is you just don't know when you say something, and again, I've said this for over a month publicly, when it's going to get a reaction. It just made no sense to me.
I know. Well, you're in a precarious spot because you essentially are the face of, you know, sports in that you're the one who has inside scoop and you're the one who's going to be broadcasting. So you are the end all as far as, oh, if Joe Buck says it, it's probably true. And so, you know, but whatever, like, who do you really get in trouble with this kind of a thing? You know what I mean?
I care, the only people I care about, honest to God, are the two people that I really answer to at Fox Sports, being
right.
Eric Shanks and Brad Zager. Both were totally fine with me saying that. In fact, I've been on ad sales calls talking about and being teed up by my boss to talk about this very topic and saying mm-hmm. the same things that I said. But yeah, PR kind of got upset, like sharing state secrets or I've gone rogue or whatever. And it's just a bunch of nothing. I mean,
because
that should be obvious. Every network right now with, you know, we just saw this golf event and it's unnerving a bit to have no crowd reaction to mm-hmm. a big event that you're watching on national TV. So there's going to be trial and error and there's going to be what feels right and what doesn't. That should be obvious. I mean, that should be baked into putting something on that's entertaining and important to sports fans to watch, whatever.
As long as the people who can fire you don't care, then you're all good.
True. I don't like people getting, you know, unnecessarily upset about me saying something or me being the story. That wasn't my intent. I was just mm-hmm. talking to Andy Cohen about really all things St. Louis. And that was kind of weaved in somehow. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't my intention, but I don't like that kind of,
I know, attention. But whatever, you know what? We live again in such a fast paced world. It's like, even though we have slowed down considerably because of the coronavirus, It's gone in 3 days. No one even remembers it anymore, you know?
And most people, like you said, took it as a peek behind the curtain as to how these networks are thinking about bringing sports back on TV. And as I said on Twitter, I was like, look, there is no traditional take on how we should handle this because we've never been in this situation before. Tell me the last time a national broadcast of a, you know, big Sunday football game or a World Series or whatever had zero people in the seats, if that's what comes to pass. And then the question is, if that's the case, how do you make it look and sound good to people at home? And I don't think anybody has the answer to that yet, but you better sure be trying stuff.
No, but it will happen. I mean, look, UFC, you know, was the first to sort of take it on in a sense without a crowd, and that crowd really means something when you're watching UFC. I mean, that's part of the excitement. It's not just the fight, but the crowd's reaction to the fight. You feel that energy, and it's a whole different ball game when you're watching it UFC now.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It is. And as a broadcaster, as a guy sitting there trying to find the right time to talk, and maybe more importantly, find the right time to not talk and let the crowd carry it. If that element is gone, you know, I think it's cool to let people at home listen to a roaring crowd without an announcer trying to fight over the top of it. And that, to me, brings the experience of being at the stadium to somebody's home television and couch. I think that's my job. And so, again, if you dip into a game that has no sound other than two announcers talking, and it looks like nobody's there, it's like, should I even bother watching this?
Crazy. Watching FC is so funny because Buffer, you know, it's like, it's time! Yeah. And then you hear like the corner guy like fart or something. I mean, it's like, it's so crazy.
It's so weird. Oh, no. I mean, you think Buffer's got to have like the no crowd voice too, doesn't he? Like,
no.
Hey, everybody.
No. He goes full tilt, all out, full tilt. It's crazy. You know, but, I mean,
that's why they're paying him in his mind. It's the Michael Buffer experience of the whole.
It's still fun, though. It's still fun to watch something live like that. You know, I didn't watch the golf thing.
I watched some, and I know that course pretty well, and that was cool to see how they play it. But again, it's four guys playing golf. It's cool because it's live, and it was for a great cause, two great causes. But when you don't have the technology there and watching golf from wide shots, you saw some tracer, but they're taking wide shots, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, the ball's on the green. Or you know, how'd they get there? You can't even really track the golf ball. So it was...
Yeah.
It was different.
Weird. Different.
But hey, they gave it a shot, and I'm glad they did, for God's sake.
I know. Well, we have Jeannie Buss coming on soon. I don't know when, but this is exciting for me being sort of a lifelong Lakers fan.
Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, I'm so glad that she's coming on and willing to talk about a lot of the stuff that you and I have flung the doors to our souls open and talked about our own daddy issues. There she is. Can you hear us okay, Gina? Yes.
Is she on?
Yes, can you hear me?
She's on.
Can you hear me?
Hey.
Oh, yeah.
Here we are.
How are you?
Just realize you're talking to two guys, one guy and me. I'm not looking for any free stuff, any free tickets, nothing down to the stadium arena, nothing. Oliver,
I can't deal. I can't say. I've been a lifelong Lakers fan since I was a kid. So
I remember you coming when you were just a kid.
Yep. I was a little tiger. Are you in an office, like an actual office right now?
Yes, we're actually we're not open for our employees, but we're able to bring our players in if they're doing treatments or rehab. And so it's a big protocol. I had my temperature taken. We have a nurse on call. We're doing everything by the book to make sure that everybody stays safe. And whether we can get back to basketball, that's a whole other issue. But right now we're just taking baby steps to make sure that we can you know, have our players come here and feel safe and confident that they're in a place where they don't have to worry about a virus.
That's good. I know you must be going through it. I mean, look, everyone's going through it, but on a personal level, but also just from what you do, I mean, God, Joe and I were just talking about it. How it will come back. Sports will come back. We just don't know what it's going to look like. You know, I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it's in my 40 plus years of doing this. I've never dealt with anything like this, but you know, sports has always been kind of a place where we realize not only for our entertainment, but also for the strength of the community and that how sports unites us all. And, you know, it's worth fighting for. It's worth bringing back as long as we can make sure that it doesn't put anybody at any unnecessary risk.
You said something there that I think is really the main reason to have you on. There are a lot of them, but to be a sports executive for basically 40 years, I mean, it started from, you know, society has changed over those 40 years. And it started from, oh, you know, you had to always have the disclaimer as a female sports executive. And thank God, you know, things have progressed since then. But you have had this stamina and the staying power. And now you're in charge of one of the most important sports franchises in all of the world. I mean, and that's hats off to you for being able to do it as long as you have. I really want to ask you what you think your dad saw in you as a young woman at USC to make you the GM of a tennis team, and what you think he saw in you, Jeannie, to know that you'd be a person that could run his franchise.
Well, you know, it's like I was one of those kids. You know, before he bought the Lakers and the Kings and the Forum, he owned a tennis team in World Team Tennis called the LA Strings. And, you know, I was like 13, 14 years old. And so he would, whenever they would have their league meetings or their owners meetings or whatever, he would send me to go, you know, get him something to eat or a sandwich or bring donuts or whatever. And I would go and, you know, bring him the sandwich. And instead of leaving to go to the beach, I would stay in the room and sit in the corner and just listen. And I was fascinated by how a league operates, how a team operates. And it was just something that I gravitated to. And he knew that, you know, that I, you know, I was fascinated with it and I would stick with it. And he could put me in challenging positions, and I wouldn't back down. Maybe I didn't know everything that I needed to know, but he believed in me, and that gave me the confidence that I needed to just keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. And what about growing up? You know, I know you had some sort of your child of divorce, as am I, and we all deal with all of our emotional bullshit that comes along with that. You know, but specifically from sort of a paternal, from the father side of things, you know, my dad sort of was there for a minute. And then when I was 11 or 12, he kind of disappeared. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to sort of have Kurt come into my life. You know, when that happened, how did that affect your relationship with your father specifically at all? Or was he already sort of so busy that he wasn't around a lot?
He was busy building an empire, and it was, for him, he came from nothing. He was born in a small town in Wyoming, and he saw a life that he didn't want to live. And he didn't, you know, he wanted to have a family and he wanted to provide for his family. And he realized that education was going to be his ticket out. And so he, you know, amazingly got his undergraduate degree from the University of Wyoming at age 19. And then he got his PhD from USC at age 23, which was really amazing. Wow. But when you work that hard, he was working, you know, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. That's just who he was. And that was his goals. And, you know, he, I think he, you know, that's what he wanted to do. And he didn't, you know, have time to take care of kids. And so.
No, totally. I mean, that's the sacrifice that you have to make, you know, as parents. It's like, okay, where do you land on that scale? You know, where do you land? And I have to deal with that as an actor. And Joe, you know, he travels around doing what he's doing. But there are moments where I'm like, I can't do this job because I don't want to go to Bulgaria for 2 years and be away from my family, you know. But it was a choice.
I think we're all put in these, you know, challenging situations when we're growing up. But what my issue was that I couldn't get answers. When the kids at school would say to me, "Where's your dad?" And I would say to my mom, "Where's dad?" And her answer was always, "He's at the office." So then when I would go over to my friend Megan's house and her dad was home during the week, I was like, "Why isn't your dad at the office? Don't dads live at the office?" Yeah. Like, it didn't make sense to me. So that to me was the scary part for me, being that young and not having the answer. And so I even went to the extreme. I think I was like in third or fourth grade. I started telling people he was dead, because then it was at least I had an answer, and at least then they'd stop asking me. Like, then, you know, So that's where I think now parents have been told, like, it's okay to tell your kids, tell them how much you love them, tell them what's happening, tell them that mom is going to be there for you and dad's going to be there for you and this is how it's going to be. But like, there must have been some doctor at that time in the 60s who said, don't ever stress out your children. Like, just tell them, right, you know, everything will be fine, and not to ask questions. Because I think that's kind of what, you know, gave me anxiety, was just not being able to answer the questions.
Right.
How did you explain his resurrection? Wait, your dad is what? That's your dad? Yeah. Wait, he's here.
Well, I mean, then as time went on, then their separation became clear to both of them, and they each started dating other people. And then it wasn't as odd as it was, but my mom probably didn't really know what was happening at that time. And there wasn't my dad around. So I think I think now the professionals would tell you, sit down, tell your kids the truth. You know, you don't have to go into the rough details, but just let them know so that they can answer the questions to their peers.
And what about your siblings? You know, did you find comfort in a pack, you know, in your crew, or was it divided? You know, because sometimes that sibling relationship can be very helpful in dealing with sort of parents not being there or divorce,
Yeah, I'm, you know, or not.
Or not. I would say or not. Or not. Or it could be worse.
When you create that kind of anxiety, then there's probably everybody's, you know, protecting their territory, or their, you know, like, you're trying to find things that you can count on that are, you know, stable and predictable. And so when everybody's in that kind of anxiety, I think it doesn't lend itself to being supportive, or at least in my case.
Yeah.
But there is something, because I followed my dad into his business. My dad was a broadcaster for 50 years, and I was really close with my dad. And I saw the joy that my dad got out of going to work. I saw him, even at his sickest, with Parkinson's and different things that he was dealing with, he couldn't wait to get up and go out the door and go down and do the Cardinals baseball game. And so then I saw that as a kid. And because he and I were so close, I wanted to do what he was doing. And so there's something between you and your dad that, even with all of that that you just talked about, you saw, you had a closeness, or you had a reverence for him, or you saw something in him getting what he was getting out of building this empire that you wanted to do yourself.
Yeah. And I mean, that's such a beautiful thing to say about your dad, that he inspired you to do what you're doing, and how cool that is. And with my dad, it was about how he wanted us to you know, participate in the family business. And early on, that where he had made his money was in real estate. And I mean, first he wanted to just be a professor, a PhD, and be a teacher. And then he realized like teachers don't make the kind of money that he wanted to make. So he started investing in real estate in Southern California, apartment buildings and developments. And so I always thought I was going to go into the real estate business. So like, I still am very attracted to that business as well. But then he just, you know, his passion was to own a sports team. And for him to be able to buy the Lakers was really a dream come true for him. Because he had thought, if I someday would have enough money to have season tickets to the Dodgers, like that was a big goal for him, was just to have season tickets. And that's how we spent time together as a family. We went to the horse races, we went to baseball games, we went to USC football games. That's so it became like our family lifestyle. So, you know, it just was a natural thing for me to go into the sports business because that's how he liked to spend time with us.
I feel like the three of us, though, carry around some weird voice in our head, like that guilt voice that, and I have it to this day, of, you know, my dad worked his way up from nothing, came from dirt poor, went through World War II, only went to college because of the GI Bill, and became who he became out of talent, hard work, the right time at the right place. Your dad became who he became because he wanted to make more money, and he was smart enough to know where to invest in real estate. And now here we are. Ollie's the same way. It's why we call the podcast what we call it, because, you know, you do get a leg up, but you also have that voice that goes, I don't know if you would have done this yourself if not for dad. Do you carry that around too? I know Oliver and I both do.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's why, you know, and I'm sure most people are familiar with the you know, after my dad passed away in 2013, he left us, you know, he left the team and the family so that the family would inherit the team. And he left my brother in charge of basketball and me in charge of business. And, you know, he was very specific in how he ran the team, what his goals were with the team. And I assumed that's how my brother would, you know, he would run basketball the way my dad did, and I would run the business the way we did under my dad. And so when my brother wasn't going with kind of the way my dad did things, it was a little bit distressing for me. And as over the years prior to him passing away, my dad would tell me that he was going to put me in charge, that he was going to give me the authority, that if anything, how he left it needed to be changed, that I would be able to change it. So when things weren't going well with the basketball side of things, it was important to me to do what my dad asked me to, because just like you said, that voice in your head that, you know, my dad gave us something that he built, that he treasured very much. And he spent 10 years transferring the stock and paying off the taxes so that this team could stay in the family. It's very difficult to pass assets of this size to a next generation. And it was really important to him that he had that opportunity with his kids. And because he saw many owners like Jack Kent Cook, who owned the Washington football team. And I say the Washington football team because I will not use their nickname. I find it offensive.
Right.
And, you know, that when he passed, his son thought he would run the team. Well, as it turns out, the estate taxes that are come due are so, it's such a great amount of money that he ended up having to sell the team to pay the estate taxes. And my dad didn't want us to be put in that position. So, you know, he was very thoughtful and specific about what he wanted to have happen, and that he put that pressure on me, and he apologized for it. He said, this really isn't fair to you, Jeannie, but you're the only one that I feel will do what needs to be done.
Boy, that's a tough position to be in, because you're dealing with family both above and to the side of you, and you have to step forward and make tough decisions. And we know how that's all played out, but geez, that's a lot of responsibility.
I have a question though. What when your dad died, what was lost in Jerry Buss basketball? What did you have to resurrect?
You know, his reputation of being, you know, fair and straightforward and really putting the emphasis on winning. Mm-hmm. And over anything else, you know, he was a winner and he wanted this team to be a winner. But he also knew how hard it is to win championships in any league, that it's a combination of talent, coaching, luck because of injuries, staying away from injuries. And, you know, one call can change an entire season. So, you know, you can only control so much, right? But my dad really, you know, his goal every year was to get at least to the second round of the playoffs. And if you got further, then, you know, that was bonus. But if you didn't make the playoffs, that was a disaster. So he always
missed it twice, right? Only twice.
While he owned the team, 32 years, they only missed the playoffs twice, which is really amazing.
Crazy.
Things like when, you know, Magic Johnson has to retire suddenly because of HIV, and like the organization wasn't prepared for it. You know, the transition of one star team into another one, right? That just caught everybody off guard, a tragic situation. And so, you know, we went year after year after year of not making the playoffs. And it's harder and harder to get out of a situation, especially in a league that counts on free agency as a way of, you know, building a team. And not that that's the only way to build a team. You can build a team through the draft. But, you know, if now you're in the cellar perpetually, it's harder and harder to bring free agents to come in because they don't think you're committed to winning.
Even if you are the Lakers, right, you know, which is crazy because, again, I'm a diehard fan, and there was rough patch. And, you know, I felt like that. It felt like but you're digging and digging, and it's harder to get out of this hole. And for me as a fan, I'm like, what is it going to take? This is the fucking Lakers. What is happening right now? You know?
Well, it's like, and it's funny because Oliver, you like were, you're a hockey fan. So, you know, my dad owned the Kings from 1979 to 1986. And so he couldn't figure out how to win with hockey. It drove him insane because he was having all this success with the Lakers and he couldn't figure out how to get that with the Kings. And so he had started the conversations with the Peter Pocklington at the Oilers to trade Gretzky because he knew that, you know, he explained to the Edmonton, you know, owner, like, okay, Wayne's won 5 championships. There's really nothing else he can accomplish there. And my dad knew that he had empty seats to sell and that Gretzky coming to the Kings would, you know, kind of be the turnaround that they needed. But in the meantime, Bruce McNall came in the picture and really, really wanted to own the Kings and operate the Kings. And he signed a lease to stay at the Forum, which is what my dad wanted. He signed an agreement to keep the Kings on Prime Ticket, which was our regional sports network. So my dad was, you know, I think Bruce will do a better job running the Kings and I'll focus on the Lakers. So it's really hard to win.
Especially in your city, your city and New York, those are the two that you can get lured into the star and the name, and sometimes a fading star or a fading name or somebody who became a star elsewhere. And now, you know, are you signing the guy to sell tickets up front, or are you going to develop to win long term? And that's always the push and pull in these big cities. You can't rebuild. You can't ever say publicly, oh, well, we're tanking and we're going to rebuild. I mean, it just doesn't work. You can't do it.
It's not when you're used to winning, not, you know, if your fan base, you know, and I mean, it's certainly, you know, it's like, I think it's like a balance. Like, I hate to say like you can't rebuild in a big market, but you know, for example, when that the Shaq Kobe era started, Shaq came as a free agent, but Kobe came through a trade on draft day. So, you know, technically Kobe was developed by the Lakers because he only played for one team his entire career. So, you know, that, you know, Kobe was somebody that it was like we could build with a draft through the draft or free agency with Shaq. And when you're down and losing, and then my brother was changing coaches every 18 months. And sometimes you have to make coaching changes. I get that. But when you go from a coach like Mike Brown, whose emphasis was defense, to a coach like Mike D'Antoni, who really doesn't worry so much about defense.
That was the craziest coaching decision for me.
That's two different rosters that you need. Like, and so it's like then the outside world thinks they don't know what direction are you going. You should be able to see a pathway as to you hire a coach, you give him the players that play his style of basketball, and then the rest. You know, you make decisions that follow the decision before, and you can see a path. You can see what the person's thinking, but I couldn't see what was going on and where he was trying to go and what our identity was going to be as a team. And, you know, certainly when my dad talked to me about giving me the authority to make the changes, he didn't really let my siblings know the extent of that power, because I think he felt that they would first not be happy with that, and second, try to talk him out of it. And he would spend the rest of his life trying to, like, you know.
And how did that go over? Well, though? I mean, first of all, I'm sure you've seen Succession, right? The TV show on HBO. I mean, that's apparently for Rupert Murdoch, right. Family, right? I mean, it feels like you got a sports Succession production on your hands.
I mean, that is definitely entertaining, that show, but I wouldn't say that we were Succession, because I truly believe if the Lakers would have stayed under that same kind of rhythm where, okay, maybe once every 10 years, we don't make the playoffs. Instead it was year after year after year. And I said to my brother, you know, when are we going to get back in the playoffs? And that's when he gave himself the 3-year, you know, time frame. And so there was no reason for me to think that he didn't know what he was, that he would deliver what he promised in those 3 years. Well, as it turned out, it didn't go that way. And then, you know, unbeknownst to him, like I had to assert my authority. And then that's when it went to court, because we had to make sure that who was given the authority had the authority and to make that change. And, you know, you know, he wasn't happy. He wasn't happy with that decision. But I think anybody who's in a family knows that.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, business, family, however you want to say it. I mean, it's difficult, you know. I mean, I'm in business with my sister. We do a podcast together, you know, and it's very minor.
Hey. Let's not promote the other podcast.
I know. But what I'm saying is you have to walk this line because what's most important? You know, like Katie and I have had an amazing relationship. You know, it's been tumultuous at times, and especially in the beginning, you know, when my parents divorced, but it's grown into something really beautiful. And then we get into business together and you just feel there's always a little tension. You want to make sure that everything is good because what's most important? You know, what's most important is our family, you know, but when your family and your siblings, you're so wrapped up, this is part of your identity. So you have no choice but to sort of figure all that shit out. I mean,
well, that takes us back to the voice in my head, which was, I had to do what my dad asked me to do, which was the hardest thing I ever did. But I think anybody that's in that position would have done the same thing that I did. Because you know, I know what it took for my dad to make sure that we could keep this team and the family. And I know that, you know, I know the joy that my dad got when the Lakers would win a championship and you would see the city of Los Angeles come together under a purple and gold flag. Mm-hmm. That really meant a lot to him because he chose Los Angeles as his home. He loved Los Angeles. He wanted to give the city something they could be proud of because he felt that the city had given him, you know, everything he dreamed of. And he wanted the Lakers to beat the Celtics. That was really what he wanted to do. Yeah. And I feel that obligation of that passion that he had. And
that's great. What's the pressure like though? Do you feel a pressure to sort of carry on this Laker legacy, this, you know, this winning? I mean, not just for the city and for your own personal feelings about winning, but for your dad. I mean, is there added pressure there? And then the second part is, do you feel like you ever compare yourself being like, oh my God, like I have to live up to it?
Yes, there's pressure. But I, you know, as there should be, you know, the Lakers is a brand that, is about winning and that, you know, that's what I have to continue, but I appreciate the pressure. And the conversations that I would have with my dad, you know, all the time, you know, he would say, you're going to do things your way, Jeannie. Like, don't feel that you have to do it the way that I do it. You have to keep the team evolved and you have to, like, you know, keep them competitive. And so while, you know, they're like a lot of the challenges, like a pandemic, he and I never had any conversation about that, but I know what he would want. Get back to basketball, how important the team is to the community. And we've seen that. We've seen that, you know, without sports, it's, you know, we don't have things to connect us as a.
There's nothing to rally around. I you know, people want to downplay sports and, you know, I'm in the sports world, you're in the sports world, so we're biased, but my gosh, when it's not there, there's such a hole in American life. And even the non-sports fan has to at least acknowledge that walking past people watching a game in whatever town they live in, there's something to that. Like you said, there's so many things out there that are splitting everybody so far apart that these are the one things. I mean, I'm a huge St. Louis Blues fan. When I go to the games, in my season tickets, I'm high after a big goal. You know, you're high-fiving people you don't know and, you know, well, pre-COVID, but you're in everybody's face and you're like, oh my God, we just got to score a huge goal. And there's just something, as silly as it may sound to people, it's a huge part of who we are as Americans. And now here you are after all this struggle of, you know, the power struggle and everything else. And you guys are a fantastic team and you're in first place. And now you get hit with the shutdown. So
I can't even talk about that.
You're the second NBA owner that we've had on here. We had Mark Cuban on. When we talked to him, I would say a month ago, he was pretty certain that the NBA would come back in some form. Obviously with safety measures first and foremost in everybody's mind. A month later, as we talk to you, Jeannie, are you still pretty certain that in some form there's basketball in 2020 again?
You know, I mean, until we have it all figured out, I can't definitively say yes or no, but that is that what we're working towards? Yes, we're working really hard and trying to get all the pieces to fit together so that everybody, you know, it feels safe and confident, you know, whether it's playing games without fans or with fans, with face masks. You know, I'm not an expert and I'm not going to try to speculate what it's going to look like, but we know, like, step by step. And really what I, you know, a lot of my philosophical parts about, you know, a basketball team, any sports team, is that it has to feel, you have to feel like a family unit. And I learned that from Phil Jackson and watching The Last Dance, you know, that becomes top of mind and watching how he brought that team together and you know, the idea that I'm the head of an organization and that our players, we feel so disconnected because, you know, not all the players that play for the Lakers live in Los Angeles. And so now we're kind of spread out and, you know, the practice facility, the office becomes like the center hub. And when we had to shut down and lose that connection, it's like traumatic for a team because they didn't have that chance to like say goodbye to each other or finish their season. And, you know, it's like, it's healing their hearts for that to try to bring them all back together. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. The Last Dance, which is just phenomenal, but it does give you, you know, Mike, of course it's Michael Jordan, but it really lets you into to understand what it's like to be a team and how important that is. And, you know, like when
especially
Scottie,
a team with Rodman,
right. But like when Scottie, you know, when Scottie decided to sit and not go in for that last shot when Steve Kerr who hit it. No, it's Kukoc hit it. And then you watch how it all went down in the locker room. It's like, whoa, you know, there's a real letdown when it came to that. I mean, that's still stuck with, sticks with them to this day.
During this crisis, you know, we had a player in the NBA, Carl Anthony Towns, who lost his mother. And I think about how he would probably feel nothing more than to have his teammates wrap their arms around him. And we couldn't do that. Like, we can't do that as a community because we're all isolated and disconnected and quarantined and sequestered and whatever you want to call it. It's been really hard.
Mm-hmm. No, I know. Well, it's funny. You guys were talking about how sports and the outlet and, you know, when Kobe passed, I was obviously with everyone else devastated, but I was exceptionally devastated. And I didn't know why, because I only met him one time. And I was really trying to think about why I was so devastated, you know. And then it came to me. There's certain things, certain times in life, when you are fully clear of thought, you are in that present moment, when you're experiencing an elation that is beyond anything like you felt. There's moments in life when you purely exist in that moment, and that is all. Like the birth of your child, there's certain times, and Kobe for me was that. He gave me moments of just forgetting about every problem in my life. I think that's what sports does, and I appreciate that so much. You know, that when that is taken and when that goes, it's just a piece of you has gone. You know.
you talk about, and I think it is worth bringing up. I thought you guys for having that hit the organization, hit the country, hit the seeing this larger than life figure and his poor daughter and everybody else that was on that helicopter pass away. Hats off to you for how you guys honored everyone and honored his time in your organization. That was that brought in everybody that I'm sure people that some that never heard of Kobe Bryant, if that's possible. But you guys really, you don't know how you're going to react and you don't know how it's going to come off. But I don't think it could have come off any better. When you look back on that, you got to be really proud.
Well, I mean, I would give anything to go back and have January 26th never take place like that. But, you know, for me, it's like when, you know, my dad bought the team in 1979, that first year won a championship, won five in the 80s. And then when Magic had to retire, it all stopped, right? And, you know, the next year we didn't make the playoffs and, you know, it was depressing. And I prayed to the skies above and I said, if we ever get a player on our team like Magic Johnson again, I will never, ever, ever take that player for granted. And then we got Kobe. And I, as heartbroken as I am, the one comfort that I have is that Kobe knew how much we loved him. And we told him and we retired his numbers. And, you know, he never doubted that we were behind him 100%. And that gives me some comfort because we never held back the celebrating the greatness that was Kobe. And, you know,
that's so well said, because I think these stars, whatever the sport, they come and go and you don't really get it until they're gone, whether you're, you know, in your position of ownership or you're in just any fan's position and you see these certain players in every sport and you go, did they really, even as a fan in St. Louis, did you really appreciate that player while he was here and while he was doing, you know, all or he or she doing all that they could possibly do to bring a smile to your face and try and win at all costs? And man, I think most of the time the answer is probably no. And the fact that you had been through that with Magic and this, you know, unexpected, almost impossible ending to that. And then, you know, having this guy like Kobe Bryant come along, so good for you that, and you can see, you know, it was there. That was genuine. That was heartfelt. That was the Lakers as an organization that was just heartbroken. And you're not heartbroken unless you're all in with that person. And you guys were all in with him. So good that you enjoyed it and honored him while he was playing instead of just after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking as you were talking about your dad, it's probably a weird question, but how often do you dream about your dad?
That's a really interesting question, because it's like, you know, there have been moments in the last 7 years that I've had these very visceral dreams where either I'm going through some stress or I feel I'm not confident in a decision or whatever. And like, there'll be an appearance or there'll be some, you know, I sometimes out of nowhere, I'll run into a person or see somebody and they'll come up and they'll share a story about my dad that I've never heard of, or they'll send me a picture or something. And it's like a trigger that then it, you know, the good feelings come back. Like you remember, okay, like this was what it was like when he was around, and you know, how important that is for me. Do you get the same thing? Do you get dreams of your dad?
I do. I mean, I'm a month short of my dad being gone for 18 years. And I will tell you that I dream about him. I would say, and I tell my wife, it's like, I had another dream about him. I dream about him maybe four times a week. And it's like, it's not like, oh my God, there's my, yeah, it's weird. It's not like, oh my God, there's my dad. It's like,
it's normal, right?
Or he's been like hiding for the last 18 years, or he's been somewhere else and now he's back, but then it's just normal. And I had some moments with him that I wrote about in a book that I wrote, you know, him, you know, begging me to let him die. And then the moment on his deathbed and me not going to see him before I went down to do a game, and then breaking down and going in to see him, and then him passing away 5 minutes after I left. These moments that you just are so indelibly printed on my mind and my heart that, you know, he's around me. And like you, I get a story a day, it feels like, around St. Louis where I live, about something my dad did that I'm like, God, he did that. You know, I walk away from this person like, okay, yeah, he set out a hell of an example that I try to live up to every day. But I just was wondering, because I feel like our dads were so larger than life in our own world and in the cities we live in, that you probably, you know, he doesn't ever really truly leave you, even on death, in death.
Yeah. And I, you know, and it's like, I've had a couple of dreams about Kobe too. And it's like, and those like make me feel like he's okay. Like it's going to be okay. Like there's, you know, because he was somebody going through what I had to go through in the last couple of years. I leaned on him a lot for advice and support, and he was always there for me. And, you know, to lose my dad and to lose Kobe and to have, you know, Magic leave his job as president, even though Magic and I still, you know, see each other and communicate, working with Magic every day was really such a pleasure for me. I really enjoyed it. And I was, you know, sad that it wasn't something that was making him happy, having to work every day and a job that is a tough job. But, you know,
it must feel lonely around
there. It does.
For as many people as walk in the hallways, your pillars of strength are in some
way. And David Stern. Like, these were all people that had such influence on me and that I could always count on to be there when I needed help. And I've lost a lot. And, you know, it's hard, but, you know, I think, you know, Magic got us to where we are today. Like he got LeBron James to say the Lakers were back, you know, like a belief in the organization that we were going in the right direction. And I cannot thank Magic more for, you know, coming and helping me at the most difficult time in my professional business side of an operation.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Lakers are fun now. I mean, what a fun team. It's funny. It's almost like back to Showtime in a way. You know, it's quick pace and it's just fun. Fun. I can't even, the fact that we were where we were, now we're not finishing the season or whatever that might be. Look, there's a lot of worse things that are happening in the world, of course, but as a Lakers fan, I mean, it's just like, oh no.
Yeah, I mean, everything these days, Jeannie, comes with that disclaimer. And so we send it out there yet again that while people, you know, we're talking about sports and Lakers and, you know, whatever our hardships are in our own minds about what we're going through with our families and losing dads and whatever, you know, this is a daily struggle for so many people out there, that obviously there are bigger things in getting back to basketball. But I do feel like if it's possible, when it comes back, it will be an emotional return for all these sports, but for the fans, for just the citizens going, man, we're kind of back to somewhat life like we knew it. And I think that sports gives us that opportunity to kind of, you know, make a statement that maybe we're winning this battle at some point. Hopefully that comes to pass.
I have a question, okay? So when you're building a championship team, right? I mean, you've got talent and then you've got sort of the culture of the organization. Does one tip one way or the other? I mean, what's more important? You know, do you think the talent? Of course you need talent. There's
talent.
No doubt about it. But right, have to have talent. But what about just the culture of the sort of the organization? How important is that?
You know, like using that word, the culture, didn't have clarity for me until Magic came. and how it's like everybody knew it was like, okay, now we're, you know, the hammer's coming down. We're serious. We're about winning. We're going to get back to winning. And how, like, not only from the basketball side, but like every aspect of the organization, everybody sat up a little bit straighter, like Magic, you know, it's like, we're here to do something. Now, this is what we're, this is what we're committed to. And, you know, he set us off on that path. And now I really see how the culture has come around in terms of, you know, bringing somebody like LeBron and then the players that want to come and play with somebody like LeBron and the coaches that we have, the coaching staff and what they're all about and what they're trying to accomplish. So yes, I think we managed to change our culture. It took time to implement, but now we're people know who we are. They know the kind of basketball team we want to be, the kind of players that we're going to bring in. And now it all feeds on itself. Now we've got the pieces, and now the pieces can grow and be bigger.
I think Jeannie and Ollie, that's what The Last Dance has shown me yet again, that you can have everything in place that you want, but if you don't have the one player in the locker room that holds everybody accountable, that he's kind of the last say. You know, I just have not seen many winning teams or teams that go on long runs that don't have that one guy that even when the coach walks out of the door, everybody's still accountable to that guy over in the corner. That's probably because he's such a veteran, has three lockers to himself. It's like the three locker mentality. If you know, it was that way with the Cardinals with Albert Pujols, or it's that way, you know, whatever. These guys in their prime, or Gretzky in his day, or whatever it might be, that the players can get away with whatever little stuff they can get away with, but there's a line, and that line is drawn by that guy in the corner, not by the head coach, not by the GM, not by the owner, not by the media. It's drawn by that guy who's setting the example every day. And if you don't have that, you're dead. And I just don't think you're going to win, especially with all of the distractions that exist today. This is not 1960. If you don't have somebody that the players are accountable to on their level, you're not going to win. Is that your experience, Jeannie?
I do think that you need that guy in the locker room that is going to say what needs to be said, and that, you know, to get guys to like follow suit. And you know, Kobe was that guy. LeBron is that guy. You know, Kobe was in the gym. He was the first one in the gym every day. And, you know, when the best player on your team works that hard, then, you know, everybody else has to fall in line. I also think that it's important that you give players the right role for them. And meaning that when you ask a role player to be your star player, that doesn't work. It's frustrating for the athlete as well as for the team. You have to put players in the right position for them to be successful. So you have to be familiar with your roster and have, you know, complementary pieces so that you're not wasting your time having, you know, eight, you know, small forwards on one team. And then it just doesn't work. Everybody has to know their role, and they have to be in a role that they can exceed in and see what the expectation that is being asked for them.
Was Kobe as tough as Jordan, now that we get to see sort of how tough Jordan is in the locker room and how brutal he might have been to some of his teammates? Was Kobe as tough? Because obviously Kobe was emulating Jordan like to the T. I mean, you're even watching some of these meshing things that the YouTube people are putting together. It's uncanny, you know. So was he as fiery?
You know, like that would be a better question for Phil to answer. But I would say that did Kobe set a bar? Yes, he did. And did he not tolerate players that didn't work hard or, you know, weren't committed? Yeah, like that. That was hard for him to, you know, respect a player that didn't care about it as much as he did. And that's what he demanded. And, you know, even like with Dwight Howard, who was a Laker and played with Kobe and then left to go join Houston, you know, it's like when Dwight came back the next time, people were kind of like, how, Jeannie, how could you guys bring, you know, somebody that Kobe didn't like or was frustrated with or that left the Lakers? And I said, I completely understand why Dwight left as a free agent, because Mike D'Antoni was not a coach that was going to put him in a position to succeed, you know, because he really didn't, he liked shooters and instead of big men, whatever. But that, you know, Kobe himself would have, he was always there to like make the team better. Meaning if Dwight Howard could make your team better, then you have to get Dwight Howard. Like he would never say, it was always about winning. So if a player could help him win, it didn't, he didn't have to be best friends with them. It was all about, are you going to do the work? Are you going to be part of a team? Are you going to contribute instead of be a distraction? And, you know, as it's turned out, Dwight has been amazing for us.
Oh God. So great. Amazing. It's almost like he just had to accept his role and he's just done that. It's just like, okay, he's in this sort of twilight of his career a little bit. He goes, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to accept the role that I'm in. And he is just, did you ask Kobe about Dwight? I mean, when you were bringing him in, and did he like the idea or not like the idea?
I'm nodding my head. Yes. I mean, of course, like Kobe wanted us to win. He wanted to see Lakers win. And, you know, Kobe came to a couple games and, you know, he was happy to see Dwight and greeted him. And it really, you don't ever give up on anybody. I mean, Phil Jackson taught me that. He's like, you know, he said, you know, because, you know, Phil, before he coached the Bulls, he coached in the CBA. He coached in Puerto Rico. And he said, you know, every player will develop at his own rate. You can't force somebody to develop faster than anybody else. Some players are ready to play in the NBA at 18. He said, you know, some guys aren't ready till they're 26 or 27. You can't just paint them as, okay, this guy is this, and so therefore, you know, give up on him. It's like Phil could always see something in somebody that could help us win. And, you know, that's like a Shannon Brown or a Trevor Ariza that came and kind of were trades that just made the numbers work. And Phil took those guys and said, this is how they can play a role on this team. And you know, bring out their best. I always really appreciated that about Phil.
Mm-hmm. Did you learn things about your longtime partner and Phil during watching The Last Dance that you didn't know about him?
You know, I think the thing that really surprised me, and he told me pretty much every story about the Steve Kerr and Michael and at the practice with the punch. He told me about, you know, why, like the whole thing about the start of the season when they said, it doesn't matter if Phil goes 82-0, he's never coming back as the coach, like things like that. He told me about, but what he never told me was the story about how they wrote their feelings on the paper and then burned them in the coffee can. He never told me that story, which I think was a very private story for that group of people. So that now that it's been shared, I think people are going to be more interested in what that ritual was about. And, you know, I know I am, and I know that I want to know, you know, exactly what everybody wrote. It's like, I'm curious.
It's funny though, because pro sports and really all sports, but they're going to analytics, and I get it. And analytics has its place. But what is always seemed to be discounted, at least to me, is that these are people. You know, like Tony La Russa, the longtime manager of the Cardinals, his thing when somebody didn't, you know, come through, and these are men, not machines. And there's some real truth to that. And you see them as these super athletes, and you know, he's getting paid $10 billion a year, so he should just go run through a wall for you. But people with feelings and people who had a fight with their spouse and people who, you know, whatever it is, or they're having a bad week or their kid this or that. And having that, or have frustration with the guy sitting across the locker room from him, whatever it might be. These are big egos trying to cram into a small team or small locker room. I think that's so brilliant and probably ahead of its time, that Phil did with that team, because I think we're kind of more toward that even during the more analytical times, at least within the clubhouse or the locker room. But man, there's such value in just kind of getting it out and getting it out of your system and having it out and then going on from there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I was going to say, like, Phil and I used to get a fight every Thanksgiving, you know, like, and I would, because he would make the team practice, right? And I was like, my God, they're on the road. It's like, you know, they never get any time off. Why? Just give them Thanksgiving off. And he said, listen, he said, I'm bringing them in just in the morning. He said, I'm building a family and this is a holiday and families are together on holidays. So they need to see their basketball family in the morning, so and they'll have plenty of time to go home and have Thanksgiving dinner with their family. And I was like, wow, I never even thought about that. And those are the kind of subtleties that is the brilliance of Phil. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember even when I got my dog, like I got a little dog and I was so proud of her and I was going to do everything by the book with this dog. And I caught him feeding her people food. I was like, you can't do that. Why are you? And he goes, I want her to know I have her back too, that she can always come to me when she needs something. So Phil was really good at like figuring out just keeping everybody happy and what each person needed and what, you know, not that a dog is a person, but it's like those kind of things, how he thinks about from their perspective and what they need. And, mm-hmm. and he
did you find spirituality through Phil? I mean, did he bring you into sort of that space?
I mean, I think, you know, not to get, you know, too much into the relationship, but it's like, I was at a place in my life in my late 30s when I met him, and I really was like on a journey of truth and, you know, seeking things. And, you know, when my dad hired him, I was like, why are you going to bring in this guy? He's like, we have two stars. We have Shaq, we have Kobe. He's just going to upset the balance. And, you know, thankfully my dad didn't listen to me. So then, you know, I didn't really know, I'd never met Phil. So then when I met him, I was so blown away by his presence, just his presence and his voice. I didn't know if he was married or what, but, you know, then I found out he was going through a divorce and, you know, so anyway, I was seeking, and he is a seeker. Both of his parents were ministers. And he, you know, he wanted to know about the spiritual side that he was brought up knowing, but he also wanted to experience other religions. And he went on a, you know, years and years journey. He's like, you know, he's an intellectual. He's very curious about everything and he has to learn about everything. And it was really a wonderful relationship that we had, for the time in my life and the time in his life. And, I'm grateful.
He's just one of those people that makes me feel lazy. Like I'd love to know about all that stuff too, but I just can't bring myself to read anything. I can't. I just, good for him. Good for you being with him.
But when you're searching inward and I, look, hell, no one's a Phil Jackson. I'm certainly not, but I love that sort of discovery of self. You know, it's important to me. I've been in therapy for 20 years, you know, sometimes because I need it, but mostly just because I just love the education in a sense. You know, I mean, the human condition is extremely important to me, you know, and understanding it and understanding who I am. So I can relate to that discovery that's of self, Joe. It's like there's a laziness, but when you're interested in who you are and what makes you tick, you know, you don't can try be inspired.
Don't try to make me feel bad about saying that. Don't try to shame me.
You just don't. You just don't.
Introspective. You're like, deep thinking.
You're just happy in your little Midwestern home. You know, doing your thing.
Jeannie's got something to say. No, let Jeannie talk. She's the guest.
I would just say that, like, you're not ready for the message yet. Because at some point, mm-hmm. you will say, I want to read this, or I'm going to look up that, or I want to know more. And that's exactly how Phil would want it to be. Again, like another thing that Phil would do is he'd give books every year. He'd pick like the longest road trip of the year. He would specifically pick out a book for each individual player and give them the book on this road trip. And, you know, you have guys that would read the books, and then you'd have guys that would roll their eyes and never read it, or, you know, make a joke or whatever. And I finally said, I go, why do you go through this exercise when you have so many players that just kind of like, yeah, whatever, and throw it on their shelf and forget about it? And he said, because at some point they will pick up that book, and it might be 10 years from mm-hmm. now, but the message is still the same. There's no time limit of what I'm trying to teach them.
Mm-hmm.
Man. Oh my God!
Yeah, God. No, it's
I'm falling in love with him, for God's sake. I've never met him.
He plays the long game, you know. It's a good, he plays the long game.
Sorry, I'm going to read tonight. Let's let Jeannie go.
Hold on, I have a couple more questions, because this is like a dream of mine to talk to you. First of all, role models. Did you have role models? You know, that you sort of looked up to, and who were they?
Billie Jean King. Luckily, like, I was a person that got to meet her when I was a teenager, and she mentored me and is, you know, still somebody that I call and really, so proud to call her a friend of mine, because she really changed so many things. She broke, glass ceilings and was never afraid, never looked back. Fearless. So she's.
And do you see yourself as a role model for women?
I don't. I can't say that about myself. And except, I know what it meant for me as a young person to look at people in positions like mine. So if that makes me a role model, great. But I would say that my career path isn't. Like, if someone is looking at me as a role model, they should look at it as, you know, not taking the like career path that I did. And I only say that because I posed in Playboy, and it doesn't mean like to get into my position, you should pose in Playboy, because me posing in Playboy had nothing to do with business. That was like a personal decision. So like, I don't want to say, oh, everybody needs to pose in Playboy. That's not the case. But
by the way, how'd your dad deal with that?
My dad, is one of the most brilliant people. He gave a quote that was so perfect, where he said, it will be the first issue of Playboy magazine I've never read. So meaning he is endorsing the magazine, but I'm his
everybody
daughter,
wins.
Right.
Yeah.
So like he could like walk that fine line of not being judgmental or putting me down. And, you know, when I posed, I was 32 years old. So it wasn't like I was, you know, making a mistake that I didn't know what I was getting myself into. Like for me, I was at the maturity level that I could do it. And I was like every other model, I had to go through the test photo shoot and all that kind of stuff. It was like my own personal goal, not mm-hmm. anything to do with business or anything. It's just something mm-hmm. I wanted to do.
What an amazing quote. That's so great. What a brilliant thing to say.
Right.
But I feel like you have to throw that out as a disclaimer. I don't think you have to lug that around. Like, that's something that you...
Try being a woman in
business.
Does
that get thrown in your face all the time?
Oh, my God. My Twitter avatar is a picture that I took for a story that ran in Sports Illustrated. And it's me holding two basketballs. And can I take a second to explain this whole picture? Because Sports Illustrated was doing an article about my entire family and about like who, you know, all the siblings and my dad and kind of like what the future was looking like and whatever. And so some people were afraid that it was going to be like a negative article. And, you know, we didn't know which way it was going to go. So now they send a photographer to do the photos of, you know, each of us individually. And so the photographer came to my house and he explains, he pitches to me what the photo is going to be. And I go, are you crazy? I said, we don't even know what this article is going to be. And that's going to, like, you're mocking me. You're like, you're, and he's like, look, I'm really sorry. I don't know who you are. I'm not a sports fan. He goes, I do fashion photography. And for whatever reason, they hired me to take your picture. And the only requirement that they gave me was that I had to have basketballs in the picture. And he said, so he goes, I looked at some pinups. And so then he explains to me the artistic part of it. And I was like, oh, a pinup picture for sure. I would love to do that. That sounds fun and like creative and different. And it was like, it was kind of like I was like a mermaid underwater with a blue backdrop. And then it's like they used to show mermaids holding pearls like this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so instead of the pearls, I got basketballs and I'm not naked, but it might look like I'm naked the way I was laying, you know, whatever. But it's like I get people like, how dare you put a naked picture of you on Twitter and it's from Playboy, and it's not. It was from Sports Illustrated. Like, and so
everybody's judge and jury in their own mind. It gets tight. Just let it go.
That's such horseshit.
It is. And so that's what I'm saying is like, do I have to like talk about the Playboy and the decision? Yes, I'm still explaining it 20 years later that people, you know, they want to judge and, you know, put me in a category. But can I, like, before we switch subjects, can I just say, like, we brought up Succession. There is a show that is being developed on HBO.
It's called Showtime.
Yeah, but it's not, we're not involved in it. Yes, it's inspired by our story. But like, I always thought that if they ever did a show based, you know, with a character like me, that I would think that Kate would play me. She would be perfect.
Well, can we have this conversation for real? Because Kate would literally like,
and she like, it's like, that's it. She would be perfect because she could play 18 and she can play over 40. Because it's like literally the story starts when I'm 18 and my dad buys the Lakers and Magic's a rookie that year to me hiring Magic, you know, 38 years later to come and work with
him.
Like,
oh my god.
She would be the one person now we know why she play came every off. Age without a lot of makeup.
Yeah. Oh, that's perfect.
But I don't have anything to do with that project.
No, you will. You have to. It's gotta be
oh, that's great.
It's gotta be
a
license.
Choice. That's a good choice.
It
right?
is a great
you
choice.
You see it, Oliver?
Oh, of course. Without a doubt. Oh God. Now you got my mind thinking about that whole thing. That would be amazing.
Oliver, you can play my brother. No, I'm just
kidding. Yeah.
Yes, I will.
Oliver's trying to figure out what he gets out of it.
No, I'll play. I'll play like a ball boy. Boy that just.
And we can't like make you Phil Jackson or anything. That would be weird.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's great. Yeah, Katie and I on like dating each other on screen.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Did you ever want to have kids, Jeannie? Or I saw where you referenced your marriage one time and you said, I just didn't give it the time I needed. I was always leaning more toward the business side.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I really wished I would have had a child with Phil. Like I wish that would have happened, but it didn't happen for me. And really, you know, the team became like our children. Like that was, you know, taking care of, you know, these wonderful players that, that will be part of my life for the rest of my life. Pau and Sasha and Meta and you know, Lamar and all those guys.
Sasha. Where's Sasha?
I thought you would be perfect.
I'll play Sasha.
Sasha has his own winery. Everybody should check it out. It's his wine is called Alexander with an S instead of an X, but it's he has his own winery in I forget exactly which city.
What a great role player he was. Oh my God. Jeez. All right. Well, we end by asking a question. It's sort of a two-parter. So from your father, the things that you have gotten from him genetically, you know, just a piece of him, what is that thing that you are so grateful that you have? And then what is something that you wish that you didn't have?
Personality-wise?
From a DNA genetic standpoint.
Well, it's funny because he tried to teach me how to play poker. And I am the worst poker face. Like, I can't bluff. I'm not a good liar. And so he would, my dad was a great poker player. So I guess I wish I could play poker. But he always told me, he said, what I'm worried about and the reason I want to teach you poker is that, you know, his philosophy was like, you have to be extremely patient playing poker. You have to wait for the cards. And he said, most people can't do it. They get anxious and they have to like do it fast, trying to like create winning out of not having the right cards, right? So he said, but he goes, I know you have the patience. What I don't know if you have is that if you get the cards, right, and you can make a move, if you will switch gears fast enough, because when you got the cards, you got to go all in, right? And I feel that as hard as it was to trade the young players that we had for Anthony Davis, we like that was the moment that my dad said, I don't know if you're going to be able to pull it off, like if you're going to have the guts to floor it. And that was really, really hard for me because we had this great young nucleus of talent that we all were, you know, loving and protecting and nurturing. But to get something of really great value, you got to give up something of really great value. And that to me was like the moment where it was like, yes, like, let's do it. Put the metal, you know, pedal to the metal.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear your dad saying that to you when that came to pass?
Yeah, because it's like, really? How did he know that at some point there'll be a day where it's like, I'm going to have to like push myself because that's not my nature. I'm not a gambler. I'm not a risk taker. I'm a very conservative approach. Get all the information, be thoughtful, have purpose, and then make your decision. But something like that is like, I mean, you know, like any of you put in that position, it's a hard.
Was there a moment you remember where you're like, okay, screw it. I'm doing it. I'm no more indecision. Boom. Was there that moment or was it more of a process?
We were heading to that path. So it was a process.
It was, but after Kawhi, so Kawhi came in and did you think that was going to happen?
We were very sincere in our efforts to try to get Kawhi. And, you know, we felt that was something that he was obviously interested because he wanted to meet with us. But as it turns out, he made the choice that was right for him. But it was difficult to go through that process because we were waiting, the waiting game. And, you know, we were missing out on other players. We could have missed out on other players. But I think once he made his decision, Rob Pelinka really like turned and got the work done and put together a really terrific roster.
And how do you feel about the Clippers?
It's the Clippers are one of the 29 teams that's trying to beat us. So, you know, they're a competitor and I want to beat all of the other teams, including Michael Jordan's team in Charlotte and our friends in Boston and in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah, but I feel like the Clippers-Lakers could turn out to be a great rivalry. I mean, is the way the teams are built right now, at least there's some years where it could turn into something really special. It feels like it has that. It could be that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can't build a rivalry until there is a rivalry. And I mean that from, like, we've never played them in the playoffs. Whereas with Boston, we can go back and go, remember when this happened, remember when that happened, remember, you know, in all of our playoff experience against Boston, then it all, that's a rivalry because you got a history. Like, we just haven't had a history with the Clippers in the playoffs.
Would you say, now I'm getting off on my Lakers tangent, now I'll stop, but
good,
would you,
God.
Okay, I'm just one more thing. Would you say that Sacramento series, that game went to game seven overtime Sacramento series, was one of the great Laker playoff series ever? I mean, it was that Robert Horry shot, double. I think it was a double overtime game seven.
Yeah, well, you were talking about like the similarities between Michael and Kobe. Well, during that series, Kobe got food poisoning from a hamburger that he ordered from room service. So I'm like, oh my God, the pizza was food poisoning. It wasn't flu.
Yeah. No, I remember that. And it was this whole speculation that like, oh, they poisoned him. They actually gave him food poisoning.
I never thought I'd see Oliver turn into Chris Farley on SNL talking to Paul McCartney. Like, about his time in the Beatles. Like, remember that time when you guys sang Let It Be? Of course you do. What a stupid question.
No, but I was saying that's the greatest playoff series I think I've ever seen. It was just phenomenal. The whole thing was just on another level for me. Just incredible.
Right, I think, so, I no, listen, here's so, what.
Go, you wanna no, go, yours? Go, go. Go, a little
curmudgeon. I think your dad's exact quote about poker was, the poker is about perseverance. And that, I think, describes you. You've gone from somebody who started at 19 while at USC, and I have a 20-year-old at USC, in air quotes, because we're not really at school. But being a GM of a team, to now, basically 40 years later, as an executive in sports, you've gone from, you know, a female executive in sports to, take the female part out of it, it's not relevant anymore. You're just a long-standing executive in professional sports now. And that, you know, that would make your dad so proud. And the decisions that you've made and restoring the Lakers, and let's hope that we all get back to basketball and the 2020 season, so you can finish what you started this year. But I just have a feeling that your dad would be proud of the decisiveness with which you've run these last few years here, building toward this time. So I hope you take some peace and some solace from that, knowing that you're doing his name and his work proud.
Thank you.
Yes. And then to finish it off, though, you got to answer the second half of that question, is what is that thing about your dad that you wish you just did not have, whether it be, you know, impatience or whatever that might be.
Gosh.
That bus trait. You're like, God damn it.
Oh, I know. Anything? Sweet tooth. Like, gosh, yeah. Candy. I'm like a bad candy. and that's like everybody talked about in his suite. You have the bowl of Skittles and, you know, Milk Duds and Red Vines and all the fun stuff at a game. And yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, he taught me that too.
Well, good. Well, thank you, Jeannie. This has been like super special for me. Joe, thank you for listening to me get all Lakery.
No, it's great. I love seeing you. So excited.
I am so excited. And then
I know
I'm going to talk to my sister. We're going to get this whole thing going, you know.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for your time. And I feel like this was therapy session.
Oh, thank you.
Jeannie.
That was fun, brother. You know I got to give you shit when you're doing the fanboy stuff.
That was awesome.
And I think you brokered it. You have the potential to broker a deal. Like, what would your cut be if Kate ends up getting some HBO thing?
I'd produce it, you know, and that would be amazing, though. It meant the story of the Buss family, you know, and the ascent of the Lakers. But it would have to be done, you know, on the up and up with their permission and with access.
Yeah, oh,
shit. I forgot what? To fucking ask something. I knew it.
What?
It doesn't matter. Well, you know that they filmed Kobe's season, his final season, like sort of like The Last Dance. You know, they had like crazy access to Kobe's final season. So, there's so many more questions I wanted to ask and get all Laker fanboy.
I know. We were on for an hour and a half. I feel like she needed a break.
I think she was ready to go. She liked talking. It was fun. She's so sweet. She was great. I love her.
So sweet. But that's the thing. You know, I remember Tim McCarver on a baseball game we did in the World Series. I think it was 2013. And in our opening on camera, he said, Michael Wacha has gone from being a good young pitcher to being a good pitcher. And the point was, there was always this disclaimer, like, for all young guys, mm-hmm. I mean, he's a good pitcher. But now he's just a good pitcher. And mm-hmm. that was within the course of a season. And that's the same for her. Forever, she, you know, female mm-hmm. executive. They don't say to the men, you know, male executive. Mm-hmm. So she mm-hmm. was kind of the anomaly and very pioneering and groundbreaking. And now she's, you know, like I said, I mean, 40 years doing something and following in her father's footsteps. And you know way more about it than I do. But going from mm-hmm. where they've been the last few years to where they seem to be now
yep.
is really a feather in her cap.
Oh, God, I know. And how she took over operations and turned that shit around. Because her brother, I think it's Jim, was it just didn't feel like he had his heart in it. I don't know. It didn't feel like it was, you know, it just didn't have the same feeling. And then she takes
a tough
over.
Position to be in, right? To be the one kind of tabbed among six kids.
Yeah.
That you're the golden one. And no, it's hard for everybody else to take.
Of course. But she's so humble and sweet and present, and I think she's awesome. She was great. I could have asked 1,000 fucking questions.
I could have too. That's the thing with these podcasts. I mean, there's no beginning and end. It's not. I love it, and yet you feel like at some point you want to go, okay, let them up. We've kept them. We've held them hostage for an hour.
I know, but we got to a lot of things. I think was great.
You seem so regretful. I don't like.
I'm not regretful. I just wanted to ask about Kobe's last game and the 60 points.
You and I, of all the things, you and I, that's the only NBA game I've probably watched beginning to end the last 5 years. You
we
and
didn't
I
even
watched,
bring it up.
You and I watched Kobe's last game together in Cabo with our wives.
Oh, remember how crazy I was getting?
Oh my God. I thought you were going to break stuff and you were crying and rolling around on the floor.
I was crying. We didn't even talk about that.
Well, we're talking about it now.
Yeah, but with her. Way to go,
Well, what's she
Joe.
Supposed to say? Oh, great. What's she supposed to say? Oh,
she's just
amazing.
Supposed to, she'll like realize like how much I care about
what
the
are you angling for? What do you want? Like,
I just
a
wanted
parking
to,
pass?
I want, yeah, I want a season parking pass.
That's all you, Matt, that's like gold. You
know? I just want her to like me. I want her to get off of the
she does.
Zoom and be like, God, that Oliver, what a great man he is, you know?
Yeah. And you think that you roll around on the floor in Kobe's last game would have sent it over the top?
Yeah. I wanted to let her know that I cry a lot. So she knows that I'm sensitive.
Okay. Well, if we talked about my supposed crush on Nikki Glaser, I think you're venturing into the category against with Jeannie.
Oh, I have a for sure crush on Jeannie, without a doubt.
Okay, good.
For sure. I will admit that right here on air. You know, I have a crush on Jeannie Buss for sure.
That, and you're willing to say that with a Theragun in the background of your shot back there?
Oh, there it is. Yeah. Oh,
look at that.
Theragun should sponsor the show. Well, yet another great episode, Joe Buck. Thank you for being you. And good night from Cincinnati.